Hello, everyone, and welcome to our session today. And of course, first of all, thank you, Jocelyn, for being here.
It's so
I
exciting.
see. I'm so excited you're here, and I love that big cover you have behind you. That
it's
is a
book it's book one, but I haven't had it redone for book two yet. But isn't that
I
it?
see.
I thought I'd be professional here, Jeff.
Well, that's pretty good. I like that. And thank you all for being here today. So we are here to introduce you to Jocelyn, and particularly to introduce you to her new book, recently published, The Water Ubers Book Two. And this completes the duology of the Water Ubers saga. I had to look it up this morning to see if there's a word for such things, and there is. So two books in a series is called a duology, like three books in a series is called a trilogy. So this completes the Water Ubers saga, and I have been reading it this week, and I can tell you that it's every bit as good as the first book, although maybe a little bit better. I think it's particularly from my, the first book, of course, has to introduce characters and has to in, there's a lot of introducing that happens. So this book really just dives into the story, and I think that allows it to, oh, it's also quite a bit longer than the first one. It allows it to go into a lot of the spiritual concepts even more fully than the first one does. So we're going to have a lot of fun today talking about this book and introducing it. And Amy loved volume one too, I see. And before we get started, Jocelyn, talking about the book, I just, for people who may not know you, I know many people here do, but for people who don't, you have essentially dedicated your life to uplifting and, I would say, transformative children's media. And so I thought it would be wonderful to hear from you how you got started on that, because I'm assuming that wasn't a pre-thought plan. I'm assuming that just happened. But now, looking back, your entire life has been devoted to transformative children's media. How did that get started for you?
Okay. All right. So I went to Stanford University. It started way back when I was at university. I thought I was going to be a doctor. So I was all science, pre-med was where my head was. But it was also at the time, it was in the late 60s. So it was a lot when all the free school movement stuff was going on, Summerhill and a lot of writing then, John Holt, people like that, writing about education and kids. And I really liked these books, really, really interested. I got excited about them, but I was still on my path to do science and pre-med or whatever. And I was walking around, I was walking around the Stanford campus one day. This is literally is what happened. I was walking around and it was as if a voice in my head said, "If you want to change the world, start with kids." I mean, literally, that was the moment. And so I shifted, as people say now, pivoted, and went into psychology, child psychology. And it's really been my North Star ever since. Has been kids. Okay, so the kids media part didn't happen until I was a teacher after Stanford. I went to teach in a daycare center in Menlo Park. And it was really an interesting daycare center, a lot of enlightened sort of teachers, there were two men teachers, which you didn't see at that time really for this age group. It was really no really and one and we all the teachers we worked with the parents, and we did to build the school and to make playgrounds and do all that kind of thing. And one day we all did everything. So one day I was the one who was there at the end of the day, waiting for the final kids to leave, for their parents to pick them up. And I decided to turn on the tele and I was sweeping. I decided to turn on the television. Not that I did that all the time, but we turned on the television. And there was Sesame Street, which was early days of Sesame Street. I'd never seen it. I didn't sweep the floor. I stood there. I was as captured by this as the kids were. And I thought in that moment, they're trying to do for 9 million kids what we're doing for 30. Get me to New York. And so that was how this idea of media, children's media, because in those days, Sesame Street was the people at Sesame Street were still trying to decide whether or not television could educate kids. It was sort of that early. And so all of their thinking was towards, well, what do kids need? What do we mean by educate? You know, all that. What do they need to thrive? It was so exciting to work with them. But that was how it started. And people have often said to me, yeah, but don't you want to write for grown-ups? No. Kids are such a great audience. And so yes, it's and that whole idea if you want to change the world, start with kids has really been my North Star.
So Deborah is telling me that I'm pronouncing water oobas wrong, but now I don't know how to pronounce it. Water rubas. So water rubas, as
That's
if
it.
there's it ends with an R and begins with an R, the second syllable. Water rubas.
I remember I said to you, yes, it goes with Wadaruba-tuba. And you said, yeah, but you could say Wadaruba-tuba. You could, well, anyway, you've pronounced tuba as if it was, yes, never mind. We've got
Exactly. You're
it.
getting my Rhode Island accent. Because we don't say water, we say water. So,
Wadaruba.
that being sorted, I want to know how you got involved with Jim Henson. And will you please tell us a little? Because I find this to be just, I can't skip this part of the story because Jim Henson, the originator of Sesame Street and the Muppets, and for the, anyone who knows him, was a profoundly awakened soul. And you had the good fortune to work with him for many, many years. And
Oh, it's important. He was a huge, huge influence and a huge influence on this particular project, because of the way he thought. Well, I met him. The day I met him was I got a job at the Children's Television Workshop. So I was working for Sesame Street. I got a job as a secretary, thanking my mother for making me learn to type. And I was working on the Sesame Street magazine. And that we were doing in print what they were trying to do, what they were doing on television. So it was really interesting getting into print media literacy and all this kind of thing and research. But in those days, this is before the Muppet Show, in those days, Jim Henson himself was blue lining every drawing of a Muppet that we had in the magazine. Okay. Those of you who are maybe old enough to remember the days before computers, the magazine then not on it wasn't on it wasn't a computer, it was mechanicals, what we called mechanicals. So there were these boards with everything pasted on them, all the illustrations and everything else, and we put tracing paper over them, and it would be we'd take these things over to the Henson Company, which from the Children's Television Workshop, which was on the West Side of New York, Manhattan. We had to go to the East Side. Not we. The managing editor of the magazine did this. Well, one day, it was. I mean, and she, the magazine editor, Brenda was the name, her name, and she was absolutely beautiful, spotless. You know, beautiful clothes, lovely hair, and everything. And this particular day, it was pissing with rain, and she was like, can't be bothered to take all these things across town to Jim Henson. I'll go. I was, you know, the sort of assistant. And that was what happened. We wrapped everything up, obviously, so they wouldn't get wet. But I got wet. I was wearing bell bottoms. And by the time I got across town, two bus rides, whatever else, the water had wicked up to my knees. Okay. So I appear at the Henson offices. And with they knew they were expecting me, and I'd shown upstairs. I'd never met Jim before, and his office was behind these two big wooden doors that opened up. It's all very dramatic when I remember it. The doors opened up. I'm drowned rat. There's Jim Henson. I tell you, from the minute we looked at each other, we were friends from that moment on. He was because he was funny and he had a great sense of humor and he was generous and. Yeah, that was how I met Jim Henson. And so very exciting time to meet him because as I said, it was before the Muppet Show. And yes, being able to and worked with him, the big influence was when I he asked me to be part of the team that was going to develop what we were calling the International Children's Show. Okay, the International Children's Show, this happened because of the success of the Muppet Show. Jim realized that he could do an international show, children's show, because he had that kind. It was the Muppet Show was in 120 different countries. And so he brought together a group of people and said, I want you, there were five of us, he said, I want you to create a show for kids that'll help stop war. And so that was like huge to me that somebody thinks that big. He did think that big. The Muppet Show was all about, his big ideas for puppetry and television and all that. These are huge. He was a huge idea person. And so that International Children's Show, that became Fraggle Rock. I don't know what else to say about, but the idea, I'm going to relate it to the Watarubas, because the idea, when it came to me at this point in my career, as I call my third act, where I really wanted to do my own project, I wanted a big idea, because I wanted a big idea, like, let's do something for kids that'll help stop war. And water was my big idea. So he's always influenced my thinking. Did that answer your question?
Hi, that was a fantastic answer. Thank you for catching us up. There's so much more, and I'm looking forward to the day when I get to publish your memoirs, because everybody's going to want to know about, well, your perspective on everything that was happening, and also your perspective on children's media and what's possible. And in terms of the Watarubas, you said the theme here is water and what you have developed. And I really, it is a children's book, I guess theoretically it's a children's book, but I would recommend it to all adults, whether you have children or don't have children. It's just a great book. And I feel like Jocelyn has managed to bring profound spiritual truths to life through the story in incredibly interesting ways, through the metaphor of water. And it's one of the things we want to speak about a little bit. And so maybe we can go into that, Jocelyn, because you and I talking about this identified three themes that we could do more themes, but we picked three. And one of them is surrender and flow. And I think, one of the things I love about the story is that the Watarubas, as well as the human beings who can puddle, and I'll let Jocelyn explain that a little bit more in a moment, but as well as the human beings who can puddle and liquefy them, become water beings themselves, they travel at a very high velocity. Wherever water goes, they can go. And there's something about that metaphor of releasing into the flow of water that allows this book to give you the sense of one world connected by water in a way that I think is very vivid, very tangible, very visceral, very alive. So maybe, Jocelyn, I don't know where to start with that, but maybe we could start with the water transport of the, for people who don't know the Watarubas yet, we need a little explanation as to what a Watarubas is and some of their qualities and characteristics.
Yes, well, what happened was of the whole, as you say, the whole sort of spiritual tone of it, and obviously from my own work myself over many years, but it all emerged because of this was water. Because I mean, originally I thought water. Okay, when I started to do the research on water, and it's going to be a big deal, and we all know we're watching it become a bigger and bigger deal on the planet now. And my thinking again, if you want to change the world, start with children. Well, what if children loved water? What if they loved it so that when it's their turn to manage it or to steward it, when they get to be grown-ups, when 50% of the planet doesn't have access to clean water, which is what the projections are now, they'll do it with love and respect rather than fear and greed. So what about that? Okay, so then I started thinking about, okay, when I had to think about, okay, how do you do that with characters in a world? And the more I thought about water, and the more I knew about water, well, the water rubas, okay, first, okay, I found, water came to the planet. Apparently, one of the theories is it came to the planet one way was on asteroids 4 billion years ago. So the water rubas came to the planet, and there's 81 of them, by the way, because people say, why? Because I like the number nine. And if there had only been nine water rubas on this asteroid, I felt that would be lame. You needed more for a story. So that really, there's no more mystery to it than that. So 81 water rubas, and they came to the planet. Okay. So then this kind of all mushes together because it was trying to figure out what they looked like, and talking to artists and friends of mine that I might design them. I had an epiphany when one very young new animator, just rookie animator, did love the idea of these characters and just did some quick designs to me for me. And what she did was she made them look like water. And I had this epiphany, okay, they're not creatures who live in water. They are water. Okay. So that was like basic to me. They are water. And what does that mean? Okay, so as you say, surrender and flow. Water has no agency. Water goes where it's supposed to go. It doesn't decide it wants to evaporate or it doesn't resist freezing. Water, and this became part of the characters, is that they're consciously content. They never ever want anything to be different than it is, which isn't very human, as we all know. But I thought that's an interesting thing to get kids to think about, I think. They're joyful. They are, whenever you see a water rubber, the first thing they do is wave. They're goofy because of, I worked with the Muppets for how many ever years. It's going to be goofy. And then thinking more about it, the fact that they don't have agency. When you're writing a story, they can't make things happen. The humans have to make things happen. And that was another really important thing. Realizing that as I was working on this world. And also, I wanted the kids reading it, I wanted humans reading it to have a way in. So along came Miriam. Miriam is my heroine. She's an 11-year-old girl, human girl, and she discovers through all sorts of absolutely brilliant plot points in the first novel that she can turn into water because her, and then come all the rules of the magic that I have, magic has to have rules. Is that, but she, this part of this asteroid that they all came, to the planet on 4 billion years ago, her great grandfather was a geologist, and there's a piece of this asteroid she doesn't know. That's been in her grandmother's cupboard for ever. And Miriam happened to be had to be living in that house with her grandmother and her family when she was still in the womb. She's been there since she was born. And that's one of the rules, that if you're a child who's been near a piece of the asteroid from birth, if you touch it, you turn into water. So that's what happens. She's on her way to camp. She needs to take something to her science camp. Her grandmother pulls out this piece of rock that's in a display case and says, "Take this." She can't smash it into her backpack because it's too small. Her backpack's too small. Boom, it goes on the floor. "Oh no, I'm so sorry, Grammy. It's all, I broke." And she picks up the asteroid, and she turns into water. So now we have a human that can turn into water. That's where I wanted to get to. Have I
No,
gone as
that's
far as I want
fantastic.
you to go?
I think that's great because I want to point out that one of the things that I find wonderful about the story, because as you said, the water rubas, they don't have agency. And we are part of a culture that glorifies agency. And so it would be easy for that to not feel like a positive. But what happens in the way that that it's worked within the story, the lack of agency is appealing. And it's not appealing because, these water rubas are just victims of circumstance, which is sort of the way our minds would tend to. It's appealing because, for instance, like one of the things I love about the story is that the water rubas at this point, billions of years later, they're spread all over the world. They aren't together because they can't control staying together. So they just end up where they end up. And so when they see each other, of course, they're so excited because, it happens, who knows what, maybe, every few hundred years, or I don't know. And I think it mirrors, because human beings in our glorification of agency, one of the things that we want to deny is the fact that a great deal of our experience, in fact, probably the vast majority of our experience, are not things we have control over. We'd like to think we have control over everything, or at least potentially control over everything. And this book will give people, and particularly children, the sense that there are things that you can't control, big things that you can't control. And it's okay to not struggle against those things, to not make those things a problem, and just to appreciate how the world works and appreciate how things unfold rather than, suffering because you wish you had agency over things that you cannot control. And I think that's it's a beautiful lesson of the story that I find really comes through. So if you have any thoughts about that, Jocelyn, you are welcome to contribute them.
Thanks. I think that's, I love that take. But Miriam, she does rail against it. I mean, that's part of her story. And so it's, it's her story, and she's the one with agency, and she's the one learning. And I mean, it's I actually had an adult reader, somebody who'd read it as a grown-up, say to me that the thing she liked about book one was that Miriam was scared. Miriam was frightened. Miriam didn't know what was going to happen. She was, she resisted some of the things that happened, but that because that's she's no superhero, and she saw that as a really positive, which I hadn't thought about. I thought it was great. She saw that as a really positive aspect too. So the whole journey with Miriam, it's watching Miriam, who is basically standing in for all the children reading this, come to terms with you don't control and what happens when you let go, and as you say, what happens when you surrender and go with the flow and bypass your normal human fear of it. You know what? I hadn't even thought about any of that until I just said it just now, thanks to your question. Thank you.
Well, that's good. I mean, but that's how I see it. I feel like Miriam is learning to surrender to the things that she can't control. And she does start out, especially in book one, but she's really wanting to control things and then frustrated because she can't. And she's learning from the water rubas that surrendering to the things you can't control is okay. And I think that's a beautiful lesson. Now, besides this very profound spiritual lessons in the book, you are also sharing a viewpoint of the way water is currently in danger. Our access to water is in danger. There is a story in here
There are bad guys.
about yeah, I was
That
trying to
helps
figure out
make
how
the
to say
story.
bad guys. Bad
No,
guys.
that's
There
well, it's a story. It's a story for kids. There are bad guys. And the company that's the bad guys is called ARID, Advanced Research and Innovative Demo Hydrology or something, some made up thing. And that was fun because I could, the bad guy, I could put everything that's going on now, how water is people, it's all about greed, It's all about fear. It's all about, it's not about what do humans need. It's always also not even modern times. Humans have been controlling water for 6,000 years. There's a great rant. Grammy is a very Grammy Miriam's grandmother, who's Grammy in the book. From my point of view, there has to be a grandmother in any story that involves children. And so I personally love Grammy a lot, and she has a fantastic rant. I think it is in book two, just about that, just about the history of how humans have tried to control water. And you if we didn't control it, we'd be so much better off. When you get rid of wetlands, when you drain aquifers, all this stuff that's happening, water doesn't need to be managed or controlled. But that's not, we've always thought that way. So yeah, that's an interesting point, and I really wanted to make it because it's true. Not only is it just to also say that there's a lot of science in the book about, and the science, and I worked with scientists because though there's fantasy aspects, obviously, I just never wanted to misinform kids about anything. So all the sort of water facts are everything's true. Everything's accurate. But the I had a lot of fun with the bad guys.
And Miriam's mother, who
She's
is
not bad.
also a scientist.
The grandmother's a science writer. The great grandfather was a geologist. The mother's a scientist. Yeah, there's a lot of scientists and a lot of female scientists in this story too, because that's
That's right.
yes.
So science is well represented.
Yes.
So one of the other spiritual themes in the book, which I find is an incredibly fascinating one, which is oneness and unity. And particularly that comes out because, as you said, and this might, well, as you said, the water Rubas are made of water. So they are made of the same thing that is their environment. There's ultimately no separation between them and the environment because they are a configuration of the same, which is clearly a profound concept to address. And maybe before we address it spiritually, you could talk about how you had to address it in relationship to how to illustrate water Rubas, given that they were not separate from the water all around them.
You mean literally how to illustrate them, how to
Yes,
best them.
literally.
Yes. Well, that's a great story I like to tell too. Because, as I said, I was hard to figure out who could. I didn't actually, that's what, when I realized that the water rubas are water, they aren't creatures who live in water, I needed to know, how do I talk to a designer about that? I don't even know what words to use because I'm not an illustrator. I don't know how to talk. Okay, so I went to see one of my great friends. One of the advantages of being old is that we have friends we've had for 45 years. One of my great friends is an artist called Brian Froud. Brian Froud designed The Dark Crystal, the film The Dark Crystal. He designed The Labyrinth in the 80s, beautiful book. Still publishing books about fairies and trolls and gnomes. He's a master at bringing, I think I've said this to you, Jeff, he's a master at bringing in creatures from other dimensions into our world. That's the best way I can think of to describe what he does. So I thought, I wouldn't have dreamed in a million years about asking him to do it, because he can be grumpy, but I wanted to talk to him about how do I talk to artists. So I went, he lives down in Devon, I went down to see him, and we had a long walk, and I was telling him about these characters and just, Brian, how do I talk to artists? How do I describe? He's saying, listening to me. I go home, and about 3 weeks later, I get 19 designs of water rubas from Brian Froud. I mean, what I was, and he, I was so grateful. And it helped me because I was writing it as a book at that time, because originally this was going to be television. And then I was then at that but by now I was writing it as a book because I wanted Jeff to publish it. And he gave it to me. He gave me the 19 Watarubas, and said, gave them to me to be used in publishing in any possible way. And I said, "Oh, I'm Brian, it's great. You've opened everything up for me." It was really a huge moment for me in terms of how this project developed. But here's the thing: there's 81 of them. I won't tell you exactly what he said, but it was along the lines of "piss off," and he said. And so, but we have a mutual friend who's also an artist who got how he what he did, and so the Watarubas in book two in particular, there's new ones that she's designed that under his tutelage, but it was when he t told me why he'd taken it on, why he'd suddenly just decided to do this, he said, "I it really intrigued him. If he gets interested in some aspect of character, the fairy world, other dimensions, however you want to talk about it, that and these and creatures that were made of water, that were water, really intrigued him." So that's how that happened. And it, as I
That's
said, I can't emphasize enough how it opened up the whole thing for me, having his work.
I mean, for those of you who are not familiar with Brian Froud and his work, you can find lots of examples of it online, and it's worth your time to look at his fantasy illustrations are really magnificent. So,
I mean,
you know,
Brian's a
it's
person, we've said this when we talk about reality shifting. Brian's a person,
Yeah.
he'll look at a tree. He does not see the same tree we see, right? He sees characters, he sees creatures in the bark. He said, I mean, it's really fun to walk through a forest with him, because he just sees so multidimensionally. So very happy to have that sensibility as part of this project.
And in terms of the unity and oneness, you know, these Watarubas as creatures made of water living in the water. Philosophically, one of the things that I have talked about and been quite fond of is trying to express that in terms of human beings, because we have such a distinct sense that we're somehow separate from the world around us. And it looks that way from certain points of view, but one of the metaphors I'm fond of, and it involves water, is if you find a stream, especially if it's a, well, it can be a fast-moving stream or a slow-moving stream. I have a video of a slow-moving stream, and it has all of these little whirlpools that kind of come up and then they disappear, and then they come up and then they disappear. And you know, one could say the whirlpool is a thing. It's a separate thing. You can identify it. That's it. There's the whirlpool right there. But if you take a bucket and you scoop up the water and try and capture the whirlpool, when you look in the bucket, there will be no whirlpool there. And then you'll look down at the river and you'll see the whirlpool still in the river. Well, that's interesting. I tried to scoop the whirlpool up, but I missed it. It's still there. Because a whirlpool isn't a separate thing. It's an arrangement of water. It's an energetic arrangement. And I like to say that human beings are energetic arrangements of life. We aren't at the most essential and fundamental level, we are an energetic arrangement of life. We are one with the world around us, and we can, in another way, tell that we are one with the world around us, because if we wanted to live in outer space, we could only do it if we brought the whole atmosphere with us. You know, if you're only going to go for a short time, you can just bring a little bit of the atmosphere in a tank. But if you want to be out there for a long time, you're going to have to bring soil and plants and create, the whole thing has to come, because we aren't separate from the atmosphere around us. So I think that's such a beautiful, it's so beautifully conveyed in your book in terms of the Watarubas. I think it's such an incredibly valuable understanding or perspective to transmit to children at an early age that they are part of the atmosphere that they live in. And I would love to hear you speak a little more about how that's represented in your characters and how you view the significance of communicating that to children.
Well, it's important, and I have to tell you, it's very satisfying, Jeff, for you to say, because I to say that you feel it's successful that I've done it right. Because I have to say, a lot of this I didn't plan to do. A lot of when I was writing it, and I know you, Jeff, because you've written novels too. Sometimes things just happen. I mean, it was much less. I often say this about things. We didn't create Fraggle Rock, for instance. We discovered it, and it's this feeling with the water rubies. I was discovering them, and the more I started working with them as water, discovering what they are, and then if that resonates on a spiritual level, which of course it is, because water is spiritual for everywhere, forever in human life. But one thing I wanted to talk about, though, was the water rubatuba tuba, which I mentioned before. The water rubatuba tuba, each of the water rubas, they have, I mean, they're 99.9% water and 1% ruba. And this comes in when we talk about the love and connection more. But that ruba is a glow that they have in the center of their bodies. And the other thing is, so they each have a different color. Again, I think it was Brian Froud said to me, "I don't even know there are 81 colors." I said, "Of course there are 81." So they each have a different color that they glow, but they also each make a different sound. And the sounds, when they make them together, becomes the water rubatuba tuba. And it's like you mentioned before, when they see each other, having not seen each other for, once somebody's been in a glacier and somebody else has been in a lake, and they haven't seen each other for millions of years, and then they see each other, they make the water rubatuba. They make that sound, and it makes, for humans, it makes all of our water molecules vibrate. So again, no separation. So you hear the water rubatuba, and from our point of view, it just makes us. If you're not a puddler, I have to explain puddling, don't I? If you're not a puddler. It just relaxes you because all your water molecules are vibrating at the same rate. Now, a puddler, Miriam, my heroine, is a puddler, because, and that means it's a person, a child, always a child, because when you get to be 13, you have a higher a lower percentage of your body is water. When you're about 13, it starts to, so they stop being able to puddle. Kids stop being able to puddle by the time they're 13. Anyway, so Miriam is a puddler, and when she turns into water, that's puddling, and when she turns back into a girl, that's unpuddling. Okay, and so if you're a puddler and you hear the water rubatuba, you puddle. So that's an interesting thing. If you happen, I won't go into it, it's too complicated. But yes, yeah, so if Miriam hears the water rubatuba, I mean, she'll end up puddling. But it's this sound that also connects them, and so there's another aspect of oneness here, which I discovered as I was writing book two, that when water rubas chant, it's like a chant, it's a drone. When they chant the water rubatuba, if one group of water rubas are chanting it, every water ruba on the planet is chanting it. So we have the introduction of quantum entanglement. Why not? To young kids. Yeah, but it's also just, we're all connected. And it's in some people talk about it being all connected in the quantum field, don't they? So that was my representation of it, the water ruba tuba. Also, water ruba tuba is funny.
And I love that you've kind of moved us toward the final spiritual essence, which is love and connection. And I think it's so beautifully portrayed by the water rubas because, like you said, in some cases they may not see each other for millions of years. And every time they do, of course, they're thrilled to see each other. And yet, it's also, as you were just describing, it's also clear that even when they don't see each other, they're all connected. That there's, and they're aware that they're connected. So in a way, they celebrate, coming into whatever contact, coming into direct contact with each other because that's special. But at the same time, they don't really miss each other when they're not there because they never have the sense that they're apart. They always have the sense that they're together. So there's a way that the water rubies represent a deep sensibility of interconnectedness, which I think is what you're speaking about now, and that I think is wonderful for children to experience. There's also a phenomena that I think you introduced. I can't remember if it was introduced in the first book or in this book, but it's, I believe you call it heart zapping.
Second book, yeah.
Second book. So let's talk a little bit about heart zapping.
Okay. It is what it says. No, it is what it says on the tin. No, heart zapping. Okay, so thinking about Miriam discovers this through the second book. Thinking about the water rubas, we know in the first book that they glow and that they have a ruba, which I call ruba energy, and it's some kind of light energy. So this is we've known about them ever since we learn about the water rubas. What happens in the second book is Miriam discovers that humans have that too. I mean, and it's as and humans, particularly her in this book, that if humans had a ruba, I mean, a water ruba says this, if humans had a ruba, it would be your heart. So there we go, big connection, heart energy. Love, she discovers that she can just send out, she can it particularly she can just send she can send out her heart energy, her love, and it actually makes the water rubas glow brighter. And it actually ultimately, I don't want to give away too much of book two, but it actually ultimately attracts them to her. So she can sit there, glowing. She and ultimately, we can actually she gets confirmation that people can see that she's glowing, which I believe we all can do. I bet you children believe that too, and glowing, and that it has that it attracts the water rubas to her, and yeah, and she can also heart zap. Well, I heart zap. We heart zap other human beings, so that. That was really important, that discovery to me, because I just wanted to talk about this, but not in a goopy way, And it worked in with the, and it worked in with the plot and the story and how it all worked, and then what ultimately happens with the bad guys. No spoiler alerts.
One thing I want to say about the book, because we're talking about these spiritual dimensions of the book, which I think is what makes it so interesting and so potentially valuable. But it's also a book. I mean, it's a story that children will love. It's a story that you will love when you read it. It's got main characters. The best friend is Brad, and he sort of is the oftentimes the sort of humorous foil for various things, and he really works. And there's Samir, who is a fellow puddler, and it's a quest adventure, really. They have a mission, and they have bad guys, and they are, they get in jams, they get in difficult situations, they have to find their way out of, and it's just a very delightful story. So just at that level, you could read it and have. And not necessarily need to have an ongoing inner dialogue about the philosophical implications of everything. You can just read it. And I think it's incredibly enjoyable as a story. And what I wanted to say, and I bet Jocelyn knows much more about this than me, but I was a school teacher for many years ago. And so I read lots of children's literature. And I particularly taught middle school generally, which would have been about the right age for this book. And so I read lots of different stories. And most of them weren't particularly spiritual, although most of them do have some positive message for humanity in it. And what I noticed is, as over the years, as alternative spiritual views have become more, people are paying more attention to alternative spiritual views. There's more children's books being written specifically to convey those to children. But I have found that often they're a little heavy-handed in the spirituality, which is, that's a book that you read and you're like, well, this is really sort of a philosophical spiritual treatise wrapped in a story. And I don't know if kids are going to really like it. It's the story isn't what's leading. And what I think you did so well, Jocelyn, is really lead with the story. I think earlier you said you were pleased because I felt some of these philosophical ideas worked. And I think the reason you're pleased, part of the reason you're pleased, is because they're not overtly and obviously present in the story. Of course, if you know what you're looking for, you can find them. But most children and or adults who read this are just going to be reading a fantastic story. I mean, there's a little bit of overtness to some of the more social aspects of, like, Granny's tirade on the controlling of water, but there's nothing like that really for the spiritual things. The spiritual things are really, they're just conveyed in the story, which I think is what's going to allow children to absorb them. Because I think it'll just go right in with the story. And so I would love to hear you speak a little bit about your process as an author and how you wanted to approach that delicate balance.
It's been part of my training in children's media, really. I mean, I'm a great believer in subversive messages because the story's got to be the most important thing. The story has to work, but it's got to be about something. And this whatever it's about to me, that's where that's for instance, that's where these messages I think come in. I mean, we spent, the Magic School Bus was a project I worked on, which was all about science. But the science was part of the story. We didn't tell science facts and then, or we didn't have a story and then put the science on it in, afterwards. The science was all part of the story. That was a huge influence to me on writing all this, was that what I know and believe myself, spiritually. Had to be, part of the story, but it just had to be organic, as I guess I want, and it had to be, the story had to carry it, and that's really important. But that I think it's really hard. I've learned it's really hard to write a good story that carries a message. That's not an easy, it's a skill. It's not an easy thing to do, and I feel like I've been honing it for 50 years. So I'm glad to hear that you felt it was done successfully. I also want to add, because a few of those people are actually on this call, the big I had readers for this book. I've because it was a normally on television you work with a lot of different people, and that's part of it's a collaborative process. Writing a novel is not collaborative. So but then if you have readers that you can give it to that will read it and tell you when it's terrible and but give you a better idea, all in the service of the best idea, then that made that was that I felt like that was a safety net for me to have people that I know, love, and trust that could read what I'd written, early drafts. I mean, when I first started book one, I did not know how to write a novel for 9 to 12-year-olds. No idea. I basically took a screenplay and turned it into, prose. And everybody went, sorry, this isn't a novel. This reads like a screen. So I really had to learn. The other thing is just that I wanted to say in this whole discussion is is Jim Henson's sort of what I learned from him, which is goofiness in the service of truth. And so that again has been, the water rubas are goofy. You have to, it has to be fun. It has to be, yes. And I'm, pleased that you said Brad's hilarious. You know, he's a great character. And these people, these characters appeared, and they were, and they work in the service of this whole thing. Am I making sense, or am I just
You are
blabbing?
1,000% making sense.
Good.
Absolutely. And I guess what I would like to do, because this is completing the series. So the first book is out, the second book is now published.
Thank you, Jeff.
You're very welcome. Thank you. I couldn't have done it without you, quite literally. And I know that you are completely invested in this, not just as a book publishing project, but as a message that you want to get out to children. And so what are you working on now? Where, what do you see as the future of the Water Rubas project?
Well, right now I'm working on teachers' resources. I want to get it into schools. I've been asked to do a children's book festival. The first one is sort of, going out and talking to kids. That's really what I want to do. I want to develop the website more for so that for kids to interact with that and design their own water rubas, for instance. I have a question from my grandson that's just come up here. I'll do it in a second. But ultimately, so that's what I'm working on with the book. But ultimately, Brian Froud and I would love this to be a film. And I think it would make a fantastic film. I think we're thinking that the technology now is up for it. So that's big dream. And no, I know what it feels like, Jeff, to be sitting in the room when this film is being aired, when the film is being shown for the first time premiering. I'm in the seat. I know who's sitting next to me. I'm envisioning this whole reality because I just think it would make a wonderful film. So
I think it would make it's begging to be a film as far as I can tell. And how about your grandson's, is it your grandson who asked this question? Do you
Yeah,
want to
he's
answer
my
his question?
Ruben says, Ruben, my grandson said, what would it feel like if you drunk all the water rubas and then they did the water ruba tuba? I have to say, Ru, you tell me what that would feel like. I think it would feel pretty amazing.
I think that's a great, it's a fantastic answer. And so I know that things are moving forward. I want to give you a chance if you want to. I didn't prepare you for this, so I don't know if you can, but if you have a short passage you'd like to read to us from your book, you are welcome to do that, but I realize you may not
I
have
haven't
that
timed
on
it.
hand.
I do
What's that?
actually, because I said
I thought you might.
I do because I've been working on it with the for the teachers the teachers but the thing is I'm worried if I will I have time to read this?
I don't know how long it is.
I don't know. I haven't timed it. That's the problem. So I don't know. Might be 5 minutes.
Read a little bit of it. Let's see how it goes.
Okay. But what I need to do though is, oh, you know what? I'm not even going to tell you what's happening. What's happening, I will. Miriam and Brad, it's in the very beginning of book one. Miriam and Brad, that's right. Because book two, it's hard to choose something to read out of book two because there's so many spoilers. There's so much as happens in book two that gets set up in book one. So Miriam and Brad are at that all right. Camp. Miriam discovers early time. She's only just discovered she can puddle. She's discovered Crakey, who's this Wataruba. Brian and Wendy Frow's son made this. It's out of resin. It looks like it's made out of water. Isn't it gorgeous? Crakey's in her water bottle. She just wants to talk to Crakey. She's trying to ditch Brad so she can go and talk to Crakey. And what happens is Crakey then sees that she's got a water bottle. He's thirsty. He picks up takes the water bottle from her and goes, "Oh no, you got yuck in it," and throws Crakey into Mayfly Mill Pond. And That's where we are. Okay. So back at science camp, things were tense. I can't believe Brad just threw Cranky into the mill pond. Why did you do that? Miriam yelled. I don't care what that I don't know him that well. I'm really mad at him. Brad blinked at her. To save you from drinking a big blob of unidentified yuck. It could have been a mixture of algae and cyanobacteria. It could have been moose poo. I can't listen to this. Miriam dropped her pack, kicked off her shoes, and waded into the water. Cranky, where are you? Cranky! You need to get out of there. The muck could suck you in. Cranky, called Miriam. Does cranky mean leave me alone in some weird language? Miriam turned to Brad. I have to do this on my own, so go away now. She waded deeper into the pond. Cranky! When she turned around, Brad was gone. Good. Cranky! Miriam waited a few moments, listening. Nothing. Where is it? How am I ever going to find it? She felt sadder than she'd felt in a long time, and that was saying something. I can't believe Cranky's gone, and it's all Brad's fault. She waded back to the shore and slumped to the ground. She buried her head in her hands, close to tears. Mom, she whispered, I really actually had a waterrooba, real waterrooba, and I lost it. She remembered the night before her mother had gone on that last trip to Greenland. Her 9-year-old self had been in bed trying to sleep while her mom had stroked her hair. I could never get to sleep on the nights before mom went away. I won't be gone long, my love. 6 weeks, 8 max. 6 weeks, that seemed like forever, but now it's been a year and a half. I miss her so much. Will the missing ever stop? And then her mother had said what she always said. I wouldn't go at all if I didn't know it's the only way for me to be the best human possible being, best possible human being I can be, and to help us all live on this planet. That's when I started to cry. I couldn't help it. I was proud and sad all at the same time. Let's see. Okay. As Miriam sat on the ground next to Millfly Millpond, remembering her this moment, I wish I could be with my mom right now. Right now, she took some calming breaths in, out. Thinking of her mother, her heart expanded. With each in-breath, her body relaxed and her feet started to feel oozy and watery. What? When she looked down, she saw her toes turning to water. Look at that. Don't be scared. Don't be scared. I want to know what happens next. Both feet and ankles were now water. If I'm water, maybe I'll find Cranky. Maybe it's the only way. She closed her eyes and kept breathing. The watery feeling moved up to her legs, then to her belly, chest and arms, neck, head. Now what? I will not freak out. What happens next? Am I water yet? Almost. Her hair was the last thing to puddle. It's not wet like in the bath. My hair isn't hair anymore. It's water. With one final out-breath, Miriam flowed into the pond. I'll let that be the
That's perfect. Thank you. And thank you to everyone for being here today. Please do
Thank
read the
you.
book.
Yes.
And by the way, if there are any mothers here, especially if you're in America, happy Mother's Day. And it would be, yeah, I would just love to see this book get in the hands of children. So if you have children in your life, please do get them to read the Waterrubas and talk to them about love and connection, oneness and unity, and surrender and flow as feels appropriate. And so, with that, I would just say thank you, Jocelyn, so much for being here.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you for making this possible.